Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Andy Murray, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport. My name is Catherine Whittaker, part of the Eurosport tennis team. I am joined, of course, albeit remotely this week, by David Law, part of the BT Sport and BBC Five Live teams. David, how are you doing on this fine February day?
Oh, I'm doing fantastically well, mainly because I haven't had to get up at the crack of dawn to play tennis like you. And we got loads of tennis to talk about. But most importantly, Catherine Whittaker, how did it go against your brother?
Yes, we do have loads of tennis to talk about. There have been events happening left, right, centre, Delray Beach, Marseille, Rio, Dubai. It's a jam-packed week. But yes, let's kick off with talking about my tennis at Duke's Meadows in Chiswick, because that is the main priority here. And I played at 7 a.m. yesterday morning, which was a Sunday, which, David, you can vouch for this. I am not a morning person. That's an hour of the day that is pretty much unknown to me usually, but it was the only time that a court was available, and naturally, as soon as I got home, I went straight back to bed. So
I think I've known you for coming up to 10 years now, Catherine, and never have I been more shocked than the message I received from you a couple of days ago showing me your court booking time. I mean, I did wonder if you booked it for your mum or something, because I'm thinking, no way is this Catherine Whittaker. And this isn't an isolated incident either. This is a number of times over the past week, and it is all leading in the same direction, isn't it, Catherine? When spring hits, you want that rematch and you're getting ready for it. Or you suspect that I'm going to demand the rematch and you want to make sure.
I certainly feel like I'm getting ready for something. I can't remember the last time I played this much tennis. Somebody on Twitter suggested I might give Maria Sharapova a run for her money in the Wimbledon wildcard stakes. So, I wouldn't want to play down those suggestions, not for a moment. I've played on three different surfaces in the space of a week, actually. I've played on a very rickety hard court in Wandsworth in a state of huge disrepair. I've played on a clay court, which was great, so forgiving. And I've played on quite a fast indoor court, and I'm just not good enough to make the necessary adjustments to the court changes. I'm just not a good enough tennis player, which is depressing. It is so frustrating being bad at tennis. That is, it's the worst feeling in the world. It's like, sometimes you start playing and you realise it's just one of those days where you can't do it. Nothing's working. And it's like an anxiety dream. Honestly, it's like, oh my God. Do you ever have those dreams where you've just forgotten, where you just can't do something that you think you can do, like you're sitting behind the wheel of a car and you can't drive? It's like that,
except reality.
I shouldn't be telling my potential opponent this, but yes, yeah. Anyway,
so courts,
I could do a beautiful segue there from sort of changing surfaces into the current scheduling of Dominic Thiem, but we'll save that for later in the agenda. There will be some discussion of Dominic Thiem because he's had a pretty good week down in Rio. But we'll
save that.
Did you
win any of these matches, Catherine?
No, it's my brother. My brother's really good at tennis. I don't ever beat him. Stop asking me. No, I mean, getting points is a victory. He's 6'6" and good.
I'm 6'7" and
And not all good, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you wouldn't stand much chance against him, trust
Wait
me.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. The gauntlet has been thrown down.
Hey, he was under 12's British champion, something like that. Something
all right,
like that,
fine,
yeah.
Well.
And then didn't pick up a racket for a few years. Okay. Let me give me a chance to get into tennis. Anyway, no, I don't win any of them. There's no point in asking. We were level pegging when we got kicked off the clay court. Anyway, this is not what people tune into the tennis.
Should we talk about real
for.
Tennis?
Yeah,
now.
Let's talk about real tennis.
Not the sort because
it really
has.
It really has been a busy old week, hasn't it, David? There's been so much going on, and even in places where there hasn't been tennis or has been sort of build up, there's been a lot of build up. Obviously, the Dubai women's event was happening last week. There's been so much build up to the Dubai men's event. Federer back in action, of course. Murray, who's had shingles, more of that later. Wawrinka, defending champion, he's had a knee injury. So there's both the tennis that's been happening and there's been plenty of talking points away from the tennis as well. And unfortunately, David, I have to report that one of those is John McEnroe Sr. John McEnroe, Patrick McEnroe's father, has sadly passed away this week. And I don't know about you. I mean, obviously, we don't always report on losses to the families of tennis players. And he had reached a good age, John McEnroe Sr. But I think this will affect John McEnroe quite a lot. I think he was a very, very influential man in tennis over the past 50, 40 years, John McEnroe Sr., an absolute bulldozer of a character. I had the pleasure to meet him once at an ATP Champions Tour event in Belgium. He had decided to come along because he had met a woman in Belgium 50 or 60 years ago, more than that, perhaps minimum 60 years ago, and he'd had this sort of brief but wonderful love affair with her, and he wanted to come to Bruges because John was playing the event there. He wanted to come to Bruges to relive it all, and he went back to the hotel where they stayed, and he did, you know, walk down all the alleyways that they walked down and everything. And he was a force of nature, and it was so interesting seeing the dynamic of him and John McEnroe Jr. together, because it takes quite a lot to silence John McEnroe, as you know, but frequently in the presence of his father that was the case.
Yeah, I had a similar opportunity to meet JP McEnroe, John McEnroe Sr., 10 years ago, apparently to the day yesterday. It was in Belfast when John McEnroe played a champions event there. And JP came along. They've got Irish blood. They wanted to see all the various historical landmarks of the Troubles and so forth during the course of their stay. And It was quite interesting to read back on an interview that they did together back then with BBC Radio 5 Live. And they were asked about what JP was like when you know, John was coming up and when he would have all of his scrapes and so forth. And John McEnroe Jr. said about his dad, you know, he'd say to me after I got into trouble, he'd say, look, you're better than these people. You don't have to do this stuff. You just, you know... But he wouldn't say it like that. He'd say, look, you're better than these people. You don't have to do this stuff. And he said, you know, so you wonder where I get it from. Our dinner table wasn't the quietest.
Yeah, I think, exactly. You could trace the genetic lineage back very, very clearly, couldn't you? It was very clear where John McEnroe got a lot of his traits from. So very sad to hear the passing of JP McEnroe. Yeah, very sad. But we will move on to talk about things that have been happening on the tennis court, one of which is Joe Wilfried Tsonga is very, very busy proving to everybody that he's not a spent force, isn't he? This is two titles on the bounce now for him. He's beaten Nick Kyrgios, Luca Puig back-to-back semi-final and final to win the title in Marseille. What a great renaissance Joe Wilfried Tsonga is having, David, back into the top 10 as well.
And I like to see him stringing it together like this, because I find him a hugely frustrating player, Joe Wilfried Tsonga. We talked about it a little bit last week. Somebody off the back of last week's episode said, you know, he'd be a Grand Slam champion if he'd been coached by Magnus Norman for the past 5 years. I don't know whether that's true. I mean, I think a valid point is made that there's a very big difference, say, between Tsonga's backhand and Wawrinka's backhand. There's a clear weakness in his game there that can be attacked, whereas Wawrinka hasn't got one. But I do feel as though I feel slightly shortchanged by Tsonga's career, given how exciting he was in 2008. I felt as though he was going to be a much more frequent Grand Slam finalist, certainly. And, you know, maybe he took the world by surprise that year and people worked him out a little bit. But he is another one of those that you feel, I certainly feel, could still have a major impact in his 30s. You know, he's got such a big game, it seems to take very little out of him, and he seems to go around a little Federer-like, as though he's enjoying life, you know, and that can go a long way.
You're being very vague again, David. What constitutes a major impact?
Well, it would be to reach another Grand Slam final.
You think he can do that still?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think if Tsonga were to have a run and play his best tennis for a fortnight and a draw were to happen a little bit. I mean, he had a great opportunity in Australia, for instance, when Djokovic. I mean, I think Djokovic is always going to be a nightmare for him. But I think he's always got a chance against the other top players. So don't think he'll do it at the French just because of the surface nature. But at Wimbledon and the US Open, if he were to really knuckle down and play his best stuff, why couldn't he?
Does the same apply, albeit in very, very different circumstances, at a different end of his career, to Mr. Luca Pui, who he beat in the final, David?
Do you know, I'm still trying to work Luca Pui out. I haven't watched enough of his matches to really get a feel of. I mean, I know I don't know these people very well anyway, but you get a feel for what they're like and how they're going to react in certain situations. I kind of feel, from what I've seen from Pui so far, he feels a bit too nice to me sometimes. I feel as though he enjoys it, but he's almost too satisfied with just enjoying it and being out there and playing lovely, exciting tennis that everybody gushes over. I'm not yet convinced that we will see from Luca Pui a champion. I'm really not convinced. But it's very, very early stages in his career.
Would a super coach help him?
I don't know. I mean, I think probably yes. Somebody that could come along and really show him what it is like to be a champion would maybe be very important to him.
Over on the other side of the Atlantic, David, they've had a very good week in Delray Beach. And for that reason, I felt so, so sorry for them for what happened in the final. It was in many ways the dream final for them. Milos Raonic, their top seed, who'd had a great match against Del Potro in the semi-finals, up against Jack Sock, the American hope. It was all poised so brilliantly after, you know, I discussed last week how many pullouts they've had over the years and sort of they've been hit a lot by pullouts and the like, and this was their big reward, their dream final. And on the day, unfortunately, Milos Raonic withdrew with a hamstring injury, and he has subsequently also withdrawn from Acapulco, where he was supposed to be playing this week. These things happen. I'm sure he feels terribly about it, Milos Raonic. He has done it a few times before. He did it in Beijing last year, didn't he? Pulled out of a semi-final match, I believe. He definitely is. He's not a guy, I don't think, that will take any risks. If he feels something wrong in his body, he's not going to take any risks of making it worse by going out there. I think he might be one of these players, a little bit like Andy Murray, that kind of panics a bit because he has been, he had that very unfortunate season in 2015 with injury, didn't he, where he had to have the foot surgery. And I think he was quite knocked by that. So I think he's pretty cautious when it comes to his body, which you can't really knock him for. But it's just a terrible shame for Delray Beach. But congratulations to Jack Sock on winning the title there. A very good week for him. A solid return, I think, for Juan Martín Del Potro reaching the semi-final. And I know you also, David, want to give a bit of a mention to Donald Young, who had a good week too.
I mean, Donald Young's results, I'm just looking them up here, over the course of Memphis and Delray Beach. Donald Young, who is a player, if you haven't followed his career, he was prodigiously talented as a junior. He was given a huge contract by IMG. He was given John McEnroe's agent to guide him through his formative years. He got given way too many, I think, wild cards, opportunities to play. And he never really came through. Brilliant left-handed player, plays a little bit like Marcelo Rios. But he's always felt a little bit as though he's slightly underachieved, really, versus his talent. But
well, oh, hang on a second, David. He didn't grow. Poor bloke didn't grow.
True.
He was lauded as a 14-year-old. You know, I remember US Open 2004. 2004. I was there as a fan, and I saw him hitting with John McEnroe. And of course, that would have been around about the time that he would have been presumably around then picked up by John McEnroe's agent, etc., etc. He was 14. And he was, you know, decent height for a 14-year-old, but he just didn't grow beyond then. Poor chap. I really felt for him. It's something that can't really be predicted, I suppose.
But there are other players who have not been that tall, who have. I mean, look, Marcelo Rios was under 6 feet tall. I mean, obviously, you know, ultimately it comes down to the fact that he's probably not as good as we thought he was, I think. And maybe he didn't knuckle down in quite the way he perhaps could have done as well. I mean, I totally take your point. Height does help in certain ways, but I don't think it is the determining factor as to whether you are going to make it at the top or not, because other players have proved that they can. But his results, and height is the point of this this discussion, he beat in the space of four matches, three of his opponents were Riley Opelka, who is 6 feet 11, John Isner, who's 6 feet 10, and Ivo Karlovic, who's 6 feet 11. And he played five tie breaks against those three players, and he won the lot. I mean, I find that I didn't watch any of those matches. I kind of want to go and see how he did it, because I can barely believe that on a hard court that he can beat those servers with his game. I mean, they are a full foot taller than him.
So we've got Victor Estrella Burgos, the altitude specialist, and Donald Young, the giant killing specialist.
I don't want to play Donald Young, put it that way.
You shouldn't want to play anyone, David. heading down to Rio now. Dominic Thiem won the title in Rio. It's a great title for him. I think only his second ATP 500 title. He beat Pablo Carreño Busta in the final 6-4, 7-6. And a great week for Dominic Thiem. I can't take that away from him. My question mark is, that's a clay court event. He'd been playing on hard courts before that. He's now going to head to Acapulco and play, well, he'll already be in Acapulco presumably, because that event starts today, Monday as we're recording, where he's going to play on an outdoor hard court, and then he's going to head to Indian Wells, also an outdoor hard court. Now, maybe he will peak for Indian Wells, maybe this is all a best laid plan, but at his state, my argument is that at his stage of career, with his potential, he needs to be looking to peak for Indian Wells and Miami. And I think we've just seen him peak on clay. He loves to play on clay. I get that. He just wants to get onto clay any time he can. But surely you've got to be looking bigger than that. You've got to be looking bigger than just winning, you know, these smaller events. I'm going to be very, very surprised if we see him peak in Indian Wells and Miami now, is my point. I do feel bad that I'm talking about a negative, because it's a great week, but I don't think Dominic Thiem's career at this stage should be about great individual weeks. It should be about the Grand Slams and the big events and the overall story. What do you think, David?
Powerfully said. Powerfully said, Catherine. I mean, ultimately, the next 3 to 4 months, I think, will will determine whether he's got a point or not. Because his point is he's trying to build a foundation and that sort of thing. And he's also pointed to having had his best results over the last 12 months versus the rest of his career.
Not at Grand Slams, Dominic. Not at Grand Slams. Well, I mean, yes, the French Open. But then he was... Yeah, anyway.
But look, I agree with you fundamentally. I don't get it. I don't understand why you go from Rotterdam indoors to Rio outdoors on clay to Acapulco on hard court. I don't get that as a swing, so to speak. But he's just won Rio on clay. Let's find out. We'll find out the next few weeks. But
yeah, you're right. I should.
I don't get it either.
I don't get it. But we should. I should reserve judgment until we do see in New Orleans and Miami, and then I can say big fat I told you so. Not to his face, obviously, because I don't have the guts to do that. Casper Ruud, David.
Who is Casper Ruud?
That's what I've written in my agenda. Who is Casper Ruud? He reached the semi-finals in Rio, lost out to Pablo Carreño Busta, took him to three sets, but faded in the third, lost the third set, 6-love. He's 18, he's from Norway, and he is, I think, quite tall. That's what I know about him. Tell me what you know about him, David. Well, although Wikipedia is saying 1.83 meters, which is...
Not that tall.
Not that tall. So I know that he's 18 and from Norway.
Yeah. Well, I know for a fact that his dad is a former player, Christian Ruud, who, showing my age, I've realised is only a year older than me, which when players that I know become dads to other players, it starts to really hit home how old you're getting. But I remember him from the tour. He was a former world number 39, good player and a good guy. And here he is with an 18-year-old son, tearing it up out of... Well, kind of out of nowhere. I mean, I know he had some of his off-season training was with Kyle Edmund, and I saw some pictures on his social media for that. I also remember somebody, when we were doing the Who's Next conversation a few months back, somebody, I think, at Tennis Podcast wrote to me and said, Casper Ruud, watch out for him. You know?
Well, he has been a world number one ranked junior. This time last year, I think he was the world number one junior, so... Yeah, that alone is enough to insert himself into the conversation.
Yeah, it's really something. I mean, he is the youngest quarter finalist at an ATP event since Borna Coric in Basel in 2014, and then he went on and got to the semis. I mean, that is a cracking run from somebody who's just coming on that scene for the first time. So, you know, it's really exciting and to see him. I did also notice he'd got one of those hairstyles that the players have when they're 17 and 18. He hasn't got it anymore. He's seen the sense, but he had one of those peroxide blonde Roger Federer 17 and Dominic Thiem 19 haircuts.
I'll stop you right there, David, because Dominic Thiem had it when he was 22. But
oh, did
carry
he?
On. Yeah.
Well, not to worry. But you know, we all learn at different times. I've got mine now at 43. What can I say?
He's precisely 6 foot tall. I've just done a quick translation of 1.80 meters. He's precisely 6 foot tall. So in tennis player terms, neither tall nor short, an unremarkable height.
And
I put
out on Twitter at Tennis Podcast, tell me all you know about Casper Ruud. Somebody pointed out you spelt his name wrong. So there we are. That's how much I know about him. So apologies to Casper, and we'll get your name right in the future.
Our eye is firmly on him now. We will be keeping an eye on his progress, presumably, David. He's not. I don't know where his ranking goes to now. I'll have a little look on the ATP website. But presumably that run alone... could get his ranking. He's up to 133. There are, of course, these next-gen finals coming up in Milan in November of this year. I do wonder whether...
Yeah, well, he's perfect candidate, isn't he, for that kind of thing. I think it's fantastic. Yeah, 133, I see, on the most recent list.
Yeah, I said that. Yes, 133. So that would be exciting. I think it'd be exciting, definitely, to have it feels awful to say new names, but it does feel like we've been talking about the likes of Chorich and Zverev, etc., for ages now, which is unfair to them because they're still incredibly, incredibly young. But such was their early development. We have been talking about them for a long time, but Casper Ruud, a slightly newer name. So that's very exciting. Now then, before I forget, David, before I am even at risk of forgetting, and I feel really, really sorry for David Goffin, because we forgot to mention last week, it was on the agenda, and I referenced that we were going to be talking about his top 10 debut after reaching the final in Rotterdam, and then we forgot to mention it. So David Goffin made his debut in the top 10 after reaching the final in Rotterdam, which is a very big deal for him. Unfortunately, by the time we've got around to mentioning it in this week's podcast, he's now been squeezed out of the top 10 by Joe Wilfried Tsonga.
Joe, I mean, goodness sake.
I'm sure he will re-enter the top 10 at some stage in his career. But I hope the stay there was pleasant, David, albeit brief.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, well, he'll be back there. That much I'm sure. I think he's, you know, you're talking about Donald Jung and players that are not that tall. Goffin is not a big guy, either tall or in terms of broad shoulders. He is a twig of a man, isn't he? And yet he is able to generate power. I love watching. I was talking last week about Kei Nishikori and Alexander Dolgopolov, and it's a similar kind of feel when you watch Goffin, somebody who's able to produce explosive power from this wiry frame. And I don't really know how they do it. It comes down to timing and racket head speed and just pure hand-eye coordination. I think he's brilliant to watch, Goffin. Also so quick around the court, and from my very small dealings with him, a really nice guy too. So, you know, that's a massive achievement from Goffin, and I think he's getting better too.
David Goffin, a twig of a man. That's going to be his new Twitter bio line.
Said with affection,
to this
David.
Podcast, I'm sure. There's lots to talk about in the women's side of things, but I have rejigged our agenda a bit because I think it feels natural to keep talking about the men's side of things, seeing as we've started talking about Acapulco, which is where Dominic Thiem will either be arriving or has arrived now. Novak Djokovic, David, has taken a wild card into Acapulco. This is in a week where Dubai is happening. He traditionally has either played in Dubai or not played at all. This is an unusual move, to say the least. Why do you think he's made it?
Yeah, that is an interesting one. I'd not thought about the Dubai connection, but of course you're right. For many years he played Dubai and he won that tournament and he was brilliant at it. Why has he done that? I mean, Maybe it is a late choice, and Dubai had given all the wild cards. I'm just speculating. I don't even know whether that is the case. It is a possibility. I've spoken to many tournaments and been involved in those type of meetings where you think, oh, do we hold back a wild card in case such and such player wants to enter? I'm quite sure that there are financial implications as well and incentives to be playing, but I also feel that at the moment Djokovic just needs to find his way back into the game. You know, he needs to start feeling the way he used to feel, and having seen some of the pictures, he's getting plenty of love out there in Acapulco. It's a new setting as well. I think that's the other thing, you know. Sometimes I think just going and having a complete change of scene can be good for a player. I don't know whether he's ever played Acapulco. I don't think he ever
hasn't.
Has.
He hasn't played Acapulco. Do you think there's any potential truth to lots of people speculating that he just wants to get matches and wins under his belt, and it is a deliberate move to avoid playing Murray, Federer, Wawrinka, the big guns that are in Dubai? Do you think it's a deliberate move? He wants to play, but he doesn't want to play them.
Well, maybe, but when I look at his draw and see that he could play Del Potro in the second round and then maybe Nick Kyrgios in the third round, that's backfired, doesn't it? I mean, not to say he won't beat them, but that's as difficult an early couple of rounds draw as you could possibly get. I'd be surprised. I don't think Djokovic doesn't strike me as the sort of character who feels that he needs to pump up his own record in order to gain confidence. He strikes me as somebody who thinks that if he's playing well, if he's on top of his game, he wins tennis matches most of the time. And frankly, the statistics and record would support that. I do think that there is something in the idea that he might want to completely change of scene and to just, you know, freshen things up. He has looked jaded for the last 6 to 8 months since that French Open, the Wimbledon onwards, even at the US Open, getting to the final, and there were a few flickers of freshness about the way he played at the O2, but by and large, he's just looked as if it's all old news to him, really. And frankly, you can kind of see why, because he's won everything, he's done everything. Give me another reason to keep this up is what I've wondered for a while, and Acapulco is new territory for him, so maybe that'll help.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Yeah, we'll keep a very, very close eye on the goings on in Acapulco. There's, of course, a WTA event happening there simultaneously. Lots of people going loco down in Acapulco.
She didn't say
over,
that.
I did say it. I just couldn't resist. Over in Dubai, I've got no Dubai-related puns, you'll be pleased to hear. Over in Dubai, now this is very interesting, play just getting underway in Dubai today. The draw is very interesting for one thing, but we'll come on to talk about Federer in a moment. It's the first chance we've had to see and hear from Federer, Murray, Wawrinka since the Australian Open. Andy Murray, in his pre-tournament press, has revealed that he suffered from shingles coming after the Australian Open. He said it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't great either. Shingles can be pretty debilitating. It sounds like he didn't have the most debilitating form, but Simon Briggs, our esteemed colleague from The Telegraph, Simon Briggs, was very, very punchy on this in his article published yesterday. He was pretty clear and unequivocal that this, to him, seems like a direct result of training too hard. The opening paragraph from his piece is concerns that Andy Murray might be pushing himself too hard in training have been heightened by the news that he contracted shingles on his return home from the Australian Open, and that there is definitely a very strong link between shingles and sort of exhaustion, physical depletion. That's not a big leap to say that there is a big link there. Andy Murray hasn't explicitly said that's the case. Simon points out that those close to Murray have suggested that his December training block in Miami was particularly harsh last year, this most recent one, under the close attention of head coach Ivan Endel. Apparently it was pretty pretty brutal. I mean, by all accounts, it always is that training block that Andy Murray undertakes, but suggestions that it was even more brutal this time and that he did look a little bit jaded in Abu Dhabi and Doha and in Australia. It's easy to say that after the fact. I mean, he did reach the final in Doha and came up against an inspired Misha Zverev in Australia. Though I would agree with Murray pointing out that he never really played his very best in Australia. I would certainly agree with that. But what do you make of it all, David? I mean, it's not... This is a bit of an unknown quantity, isn't it, hearing a player talk about shingles? Can you think of any other examples of a tennis player suffering from shingles?
No, I don't remember any other player coming down with shingles, to my knowledge. I remember about 7 or 8 years ago, Murray had to pull out, I think, of Dubai with a virus, and it was around about this time of year, and there was the feel that, yeah, actually you can reduce your immune system and be more prone to these kind of things if you're not careful. And that is an interesting one. I think it's unproven, isn't it? It's guesswork from our position. I mean, Simon's obviously got sources there that he's spoken to, and he has mentioned that to me before, that, you know, that may have been a factor in that relatively early defeat at the Australian Open. And let's be honest, Andy Murray didn't really look himself throughout that Australian Open. He wasn't 100% convincing throughout that tournament, and during that match, certainly he didn't look himself at all. But off-season training is a real balance, isn't it? Because you can imagine overdoing it. I've seen players do it before and come down with viruses in the past. A lot of them have come down with things like glandular fever in the past. And I think that the immune system elements there are a factor. But I don't know. I mean... He always feels, Murray, that he needs to train like a demon in the off season in order to feel at his best mentally on the court as well. But I just feel that you're on that knife edge. You can go too far. It is possible that he overdid this one.
Yeah, definitely. As I say, Simon, very, very punchy on it. Check out his article. He does seem to have his sources. But I guess time will tell. We'll see how he plays in Dubai this week. He has got Malik Djaziri in the first round, which is not a particularly easy first round. Roger Federer has Benoit Paire. Projected quarterfinals are Murray, Muller, Federer, Puy. That would be interesting. And in the bottom half, Monfils, Bautista Agut and Wawrinka, the defending champion. He's been suffering from a bit of a knee injury, which he says he's shaken off now, up against Thomas Burdick. Thomas Burdick ranked at number 14 in the world. He says it feels unusual to be outside the top 10. Unusual is how he's describing it. I'm sure he'll be very, very keen to get back there. Roger Federer, David, has been speaking ahead of his return to action in Dubai, his hotly anticipated return, we might call it. He said all sorts of interesting things. He's done quite a few interviews. He's done one with Barry Flatman in the Sunday Times. He did one with Reem Abilil in Dubai Sport 360. All of them really interesting. He just always is interesting. He signed this 3-year deal with the Basel tournament. He says, as long as I'm playing, I'll be playing there, which sounds to me like, injury permitting, he intends to play for at least another 3 years. Is that how you interpret that?
Yes, it is. I still wouldn't read a whole lot into it, because I think it's perfectly possible that in a year or 18 months he may just decide he's had enough and that's the end of it. That contract he signed with Basel, I'm quite sure, won't be something that he has to keep to and play tennis in order to fulfil necessarily. But I do think it is a statement of intent to himself that I think... In the words of a couple of the articles I read, that while I'm feeling like this, why would I not want to play? The difference between him and Sampras in the latter stages of his career are so significant. Pete Sampras was 31. He hadn't won a title in a couple of years. Then he managed to get that US Open title, and he tried to make a comeback, or he tried to come back off that and start another season to keep going. And he just said it wasn't there. He did not have the fire in his belly anymore. He went training with Paul Annacone, his coach, and he just couldn't see a reason to do it anymore. And to go around the circuit with Sampras at the time, as I did, he was just trying to get the landmarks. He was trying to get the records because he felt that that's what his personal record deserved, and what he craved was the title winning feeling. He didn't enjoy the day to day anymore. It seemed to me he looked tired. He looked burnt out, exhausted by it all. Federer doesn't look like that at all. We talked about it a number of times. If you even go back to when we first saw him in that periscope of his own training session at the outset of the season, he looked like a freshly hatched chick. He looked so excited to be out in the open and playing tennis again, out in his domain, and he's like that every week now. So while he's fit, he'll keep on playing. I'm quite sure of it. Why wouldn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he looks like a bloke that just can't believe his luck. To me, which is a fantastic sight. There's so many fantastic quotes from all these interviews and press conferences he's done. He said he still wakes up in the morning and remembers that he won the Australian Open title and smiles to himself. He says this one, sort of the joy of winning this one, has stuck with him longer than any other Grand Slam title he's won. He says his friends have been pressuring him to sort of have a movie night and rewatch the whole final, which he's so far resisted, but he does admit that he's watched the highlights quite a few times. He gave some great quotes about Serena Williams, saying how much he's inspired by her. That was really interesting. He says he doesn't see himself as the favourite for Dubai, which is interesting. I mean, he's not by any means the top seed, so I suppose that makes sense. Just one other thing to draw attention to is his quotes on the clay court season. Just to read them out to you, he said, "I know the French is going to be hard just because I would have to put in so much work on the clay court season to be really perfectly ready for the French. And then, even then, there is no guarantee. I have to ask myself the question, how much am I going to put into the French Open?" Now, that's pretty open-ended. It sounds like he hasn't made up his mind, but it also sounds like he's not going to be playing a full-on clay court season to me, David. What do you make of that?
Well, it would make sense to me because the best chance he's got of doing this again, and one of the interviews he said the only way I could top this is maybe if I had another 2 years off and then came out and won Wimbledon for an eighth time. Now, of course, he doesn't intend to take 2 years off, but winning an eighth Wimbledon is certainly something he feels, I reckon, that he can do. And I'm quite sure he is capable of doing that if things fall his way and if he finds that level of form that he's capable of. The best chance of him finding that form is to go into Wimbledon fresh and feeling good, feeling physically right the way he did throughout much of Australia. I know he had that twinge that he's still nursing at the moment, but if he were to play a full clay court season and lose that feeling of freshness, I think it would hurt his chances at Wimbledon at the age that he's at. Ivan Lendl played sparingly in the latter stages of his career as he tried to win that elusive Wimbledon title. He didn't manage to do it, but his view was, I've already won the French a number of times, I'm just going to skip that and play Wimbledon. And he did that twice. I don't think Federer will do that. I think he will play, but I think he'll freewheel. I think he'll play maybe a couple of clay court events and then the French. Don't think we'll see him much more than, say, Madrid and Monte Carlo. Maybe that's it, and then the French.
I don't think he'd play Madrid. I think he'd play Rome over Madrid, don't you? I think if he's going to miss one, I think it would be Madrid.
Madrid's the one he's always done well at, in terms of the quick conditions. I think he likes that.
I think he likes the history of Rome, though. I think he likes the stature of the tournament. But yeah, I mean, look, who knows?
If they put blue clay down, he'll definitely go.
Yeah, he loved the blue clay. He's one of the only players that loved the blue clay. Maybe they'll do that. Just it's like laying down the red carpet for someone, and we'll lay down the blue clay just for you, Roger. We must talk about the WTA Tour, because they have just finished their week in Dubai. And Elena Svitolina, David, won the title there. She is making her top 10 debut. And I've written in the agenda here, are there similarities to Karolina Pliskova this time last year? Much, much talked about player, definitely has all the equipment, plays a lot, sneaking there into the top 10, but perhaps not talked about as much as she could be, because her record at the biggest events, her record at the Slams, is so bad. She hasn't announced herself onto the biggest stage yet, but is it just a matter of time?
Well, I think I said at the start of the season, or towards the end of last season, I think when I was in Singapore, my feeling was that next Singapore, Svitolina will be there in the top eight. She feels like she has that ability to string results together. Different case at the Slams, and the way I would differ her to Pliskova. Pliskova has a massive game. You know, it's if it's on, you're in trouble, but it can sometimes be off. Svitolina, I think, is a much more consistent player generally in terms of her game. I don't think she has quite the degree of power, the weapons, and she does get really nervous sometimes when she's closing in on big victories. So I think that's probably cost her at the Slams. I think she's sometimes got a little too anxious. But this is somebody, I think, who will just keep on punching the clock. She has huge drive to get better all the time. I think she will be a regular top 10 player now for the next few years. There's no reason, though, really, why she can't do what Kerber has done in terms of, you look at their game styles, and neither one of them has got brutal, explosive power, but both of them can be very, very effective. I think she will figure it out at Slams, but yeah, I think that may even still take another year.
She's still working with Justine Henin, isn't she?
Not anymore.
So.
No,
but when did that split
together.
Up?
They were together for a period last year, I think towards the end of the year before as well.
They were certainly together at the end of the year. She didn't travel very much, Henin, but they certainly were at the end of the year. I don't remember hearing any reports of them having. I know she wasn't in Australia, but I wonder if it's sort of an official split or whether. I don't know. I don't know.
She was with somebody else earlier this year. I can't for the life remember who she was coached by at the start of this year, but she's been with somebody else this year.
But in her quotes after winning Dubai yesterday, 2 days ago, she said she wanted to do it for Justine. She said she was very disappointed with her performance in Dubai last year when Henin, I think, had been with her. And she was very pleased to do this for Justine Henin. So they obviously, you know, still have a close relationship. It's going to be very interesting. Another great week for Caroline Wozniacki. She reached the final in Dubai, backing up the performance in Doha, which is very impressive because I heard so many reports about how different the conditions were in Dubai to in Doha in terms of court speed. I know they suffered again with rain, didn't they? They are having a bit of a torrid time in the Middle East with rain. We wish them well this week for the ATP event. Not a particularly great week for Pliskova. She lost in the second round, her first match, of course, because she got the bye in the first round to Kiki Mladenovic. Do you think she's playing too much tennis, David? Pliskova, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, I do think she's prone to that. And I think sometimes these players, you know, they set their calendar out for the year and then they don't really bargain for if they have a great week somewhere and they win and they win two in a row and then suddenly they've got to play a third one. You know, I think sometimes that is a problem. It is quite funny, isn't it? I mean, we had the show where we were bigging up Zverev a couple of weeks ago, then he loses first round for a couple of weeks. We tell everybody that Pliskova could be the next world number one. She loses his first round. Then Kerber, who we've written off, has a decent week last week. Not doing much for our credibility here, am I? But the fact is that scheduling, and you've discussed it with team, obviously, and that there are others too. Even Andy Murray's off-court season pattern, and now Federer, how much clay does he play? Scheduling oneself is a real art in itself. If players who get that right, and I think Federer is the master of it now, not everybody can operate on his level, but it is a real art in itself.
Well, how about Kerber then? Good week for her, but an eventual loss to Svitolina in the semi-finals. What do you make of that? It's her second loss to Svitolina of the year. Obviously, there's no shame in it. We've talked already about what a good player Svitolina is. It's something to build on, would you say, for Kerber?
Yeah, I thought it was a much better week, actually, for Angelique Kerber and just what she needed. I believe she was injured, actually, towards the latter end of that match. But I'm just trying to work out what that injury was. But I'm fairly sure, yeah, she beat an injured Angelique Kerber is what I'm reading here. Take nothing away from Svitolina, a very good player. But, you know, Kerber is another one. You wonder whether at some point the miles on the clock of last year, as well as all the emotional and pressure-based difficulties that she's perhaps undergone, might be a cause of it. She had a knee problem, she said. She felt some pain at the end of the match against Svitolina, a match she lost 6-3, 7-6. But, you know, there's a heck of a lot of tennis being played by Angelique Kerber over the last 18 months, and you wonder whether that may take its toll. But I think, generally speaking, from a mental and psychological perspective, a really positive week for her.
Yeah, given how many difficult weeks she's had, a run to the semi-finals in a place we talked about last week where she'd only won one previous match has to be seen as a good week. I think that pretty much rounds up what's been happening tennis-wise, David, for the week. In terms of other things, we had Roger Federer in Prague, didn't we, promoting the Laver Cup, this new... they're very keen not for it not to be called an exhibition, but to all intents and purposes, it is an exhibition in that it has no sort of tour or ITF status, but everybody pointing out that it will be a very competitive team event in a fixed location, which is interesting in the context of the ITF consultation on the Davis and Fed Cups. That's one of the things that's been being talked about, a single fixed location for Davis Cup, certainly for finals. That sold out within hours of being announced, and I know that a lot of that will be the Federer effect, but that fact alone shows that fixed location team competition, David, does work.
Does work if you've got Roger Federer and Rafael
Nadal. Do you think it's just that?
you could put those two in any location in the world where the people have got enough money to spend and people will come and watch, or if it's reachable by an airport. I don't think it proves anything. I really don't. I mean, you know, if you got the Davis Cup final of last year between Croatia and Argentina and put that somewhere completely different, I am struggling to believe that you get a full stadium based on the players there. I mean, you would get a good following from Argentina. We saw that. They had a lot of fans in that stadium. But I don't think people from Croatia, and I know Croatia very well, I think there's a limit to how many people can make that trip. So, you know, if you're trying to fill a 10 to 15,000 seat stadium, I'm not convinced, and I may be wrong, but I do feel that it is star driven, the Laver Cup in this example.
Appearance fees, David, is something we occasionally sort of obliquely reference on the podcast, but very rarely sort of tackle head on. It's one of these, it's not a dirty secret of the tennis tour. It is a fact of the tennis tour, certainly a huge factor in exhibition tennis, of which there are varying degrees. Will, in order to get the star power of Federer and Nadal and to guarantee that sold out stadium within hours, give us an idea of how eye watering the sums of money involved might potentially be.
Well, for the Laver Cup, I'm not sure with that one because I think Federer's management company is involved in the staging of it. So I think, I mean, in his case, it may be right. Well, I want this to happen, and I'll take a percentage of the revenue, and I'll play. You know, that's a way that he could approach something like that. But I mean, you know, tournaments that Roger Federer plays, he is getting. If they're sort of,
it's millions, isn't it? Dollars wise, it's millions.
It certainly can be in that ballpark. You can certainly be over a million for a number of events that he would play. I'm quite sure of that.
You can understand it though, can't you? I mean, if it guarantees you sold out stadiums, you know, look at what happened in Hopman Cup in Perth. You know, they had a full stadium for his practices. They weren't selling tickets to that. They were opening up the stadium for free, I believe. But people were filling out an 8,000 seater stadium just to watch the guy practice. So it sounds like eye watering sums of money, but if you see that as a guarantee of TV rights and full stadiums and the whole thing looking and feeling great, he pays it back, I suppose. Just on the subject of non-tour tennis, David, I believe you have some tiebreak tens news for us.
Yes, there is a new tiebreak tens event in Madrid a couple of days before the Madrid ATP 1000 and Premier Mandatory tournaments take place. So early May, they're going to run two events side by side in the one night, men's and women's, both of them eight players apiece. Both of them knockout this time, so not round robin, they're playing knockout, which I'd be quite interested to see how that works. But first to 10 point tie breaks for every match. The men's side has announced so far Nishikori and Feliciano Lopez. The women's event has announced Maria Sharapova. There'll be many more players announced over the next few weeks, of course. Be quite interesting to see how that works in Madrid at a big 1,000 event. We're also, Catherine, we were going to talk about my childhood tennis memory, which I've been doing on Twitter this week. But we've kind of run out of time, and I really want to make sure we get enough time to discuss it. It's a bit like the David Goffin of next week.
Because, why don't you just give us a couple? Give us a couple,
well,
David.
Oh, my childhood tennis memory. People have been talking about when they were watching Boris Becker win Wimbledon at the age of 17. People were talking about how they watched on a black and white television matches from the 60s and 70s, and it made them fall in love with the sport. I love a bit of nostalgia, Catherine. And when you've got as many years on the clock as I have, there's plenty of nostalgia to be going around, believe me. So I'll be unearthing all of mine when we eventually get to that. But my childhood tennis memory, hashtag at tennis podcast, if you'd like to get involved in that, and we'll read out the very best ones when we finally get a little window.
We'll save it for a quieter week, shall we, in order to do it justice. How inconvenient that there's been all this, you know, actual tennis happening that we have to talk about. And Roger Federer has been giving interesting interviews and Djokovic has been taking wildcards into places. It's blooming inconvenient, isn't it?
It certainly is. We haven't even had pole vault this week. Again, you've done the agenda and again, we miss out.
To be honest, if there'd been less discussion of my bid for a Wimbledon wildcard, we might.
Did you see that I ran a pole vault about who won your match?
No, but I mean, there it, and that you've just proven the pointlessness of pole vault. I mean,
do you want another result?
Not really. Go on 52, then.
52% of those who voted reckoned that your brother would beat you. 48% were backing
Catherine.
On
the basis of what knowledge? Like, I mean, literally, so pointless.
Anybody who's listened to the 284 episodes of this podcast to date knows that your brother is handsomely better than you at tennis.
And yet only 52% think that he would. I mean, I can't. We're ending this conversation. We're ending this podcast, David. You might have bags of time to spare to dedicate to this whimsy, but I've got naps to have, David. So on that note, this has been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Eurosport. We will be back in a week's time with more tennis and non-pole vault related news. We'll speak to you then.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.